Introducing two new and improved Jeremy's Razors. Fighting the left and building the future means constantly bringing your best, and that's exactly what Jeremy's Razors is doing. Choose between the new and improved Precision 5 Razor for an exceptionally smooth and close shave, or the brand new Sprint 3 Razor for a quick, clean shave. The new razors feature top-to-bottom redesign. Enjoy an ergonomic handle designed for superior durability. The new coated stainless steel blades are sharper, so they last longer. Increased flexibility allows the razor to better contour to your face to reduce nicks and cuts. Plus, the lubricating strip is now equipped with argan oil and aloe. It's time to toss out that woke razor and get yourself a Precision 5 or Sprint 3 trial kit today. Pledge to fight the left and build a future with Jeremy's Razors. Go to jeremysrazors.com and order yours today.
Today on the Matt Walsh Show, as the campus protests continue to rage, one thing is becoming very clear. The Free Palestine movement is BLM repackaged and funded by the same people. I'll show the proof today. Also, Tennessee Democrats stage a die-in to protest a bill that would allow some teachers to carry guns in class. A bystander is condemned for refusing to intervene as a woman was robbed right in front of him. But can we really expect men to intervene given the consequences in our culture today? And the internet is horrified by a video of a normal guy working a normal 9-to-5 job. What's so horrifying about it, and what does this reaction say about our society? We'll talk about all that and more today on The Matt Walsh Show. It's 2024, and if you're still spending your money with woke companies, well, cut it out. There are a lot of great companies out there that aren't shoving diversity and inclusion initiatives down the throats of their employees or their customers. Maybe you're already doing business with some of those companies. That's great. Maybe you're boycotting companies who have made headlines by acquiring the latest trans influencer as their spokesperson. Even better. But have you given much thought to where your money is currently invested? A lot of big wealth management companies make billions of dollars investing your money however they want, wherever they want. Even if that means investing in businesses who don't care about your values, align your portfolio with your principles today with my friends at Constitution Wealth. Constitution Wealth is the patriot's choice in wealth management. They'll help you build a solid investment plan while reducing your investments in the ESGs and DEIs, companies that care more about global warming and diversity ratios than they do about your return on investment. And with Constitution Wealth, you can start using your shareholder votes to support conservative action. Fight the culture war with your most valuable weapon, your investments. Help build a parallel economy by working with an investment firm composed of professionals who are patriots like you. Go to constitutionwealth.com/Matt and sign up for a free consultation today. That's constitutionwealth.com/Matt. It wasn't too long ago that Columbia University, like pretty much every school in the country, shut down in-person classes because of COVID. In fact, when Columbia's current class of seniors began attending the school as freshmen 4 years ago, they had to log into virtual classes for pretty much their entire freshman year. Supposedly, this was a once-in-a-lifetime event. Extreme times require extreme measures, those students were told. Never mind that those measures were pointless and did far more harm than good, of course, but still, that's what they were told. Now, just a couple of years later, extreme times are back, apparently, and once again, lockdown measures are required. Columbia has just shut down in-person classes yet again in favor of mandatory virtual learning, quote-unquote, for the last week of the semester. And those same Columbia seniors who had to attend online classes as freshmen are now being told to do it again as seniors. But this time around, the reason that on-campus classes are suspended is not COVID, but rather that Columbia has been overrun by a mob of anti-Israel protesters who have occupied the lawn on campus and in some cases were captured on camera harassing and even explicitly threatening Jewish students with violence. Now, the people occupying the lawn, most of them students, say that they won't leave until Columbia divests from, quote, anything related to Israel, whatever exactly that means. And for some reason, Columbia didn't immediately have these students arrested and expelled, which would have been very easy to do and should have been done, but it wasn't, so the debacle continues. Other schools like NYU, the University of Mexico, and even Cal Poly Humboldt have seen similar protests. Now, at this rate, it seems unlikely that Columbia University's campus will even exist in a few years. The university will probably become an online program like the University of Phoenix or something like that. The Quad will transform into Chaz 2.0, run by some theater kid posing as a warlord. That's where this is headed. And the people running Columbia, like the rest of the Ivy League, very clearly don't have any strong interest in teaching students. They've made it extremely clear that They're easy to walk all over. So, of course, this will keep happening. At the same time, regardless of whether these administrators are cowards or simply incompetent or both, usually it's both, it's clear that these protests serve a purpose that's much bigger than Columbia University. The disruption, it just so happens, is dominating the national news cycle right on schedule in the spring before a presidential election. This is usually when we see race riots. They usually happen around this time. And as I've discussed before, there's been no shortage of attempts by the media this year to incite more race riots. But those attempts have all failed so far. Maybe they'll have better luck in the near future, but so far it's failed. And so now, instead of race riots, right on cue, we have this insurgent movement to quote-unquote free Palestine, which is really just a race riot repackaged and draped in a green, black, and white flag. Now, those students, for the most part, who are involved in this, they don't necessarily see this as a BLM reboot, but that's what it is. And that's what political forces much more powerful than the students are determined to turn it into. Those forces see an opportunity that really has very little to do with Israel or Gaza. And if they succeed, there will be a lot of violence and disruption this year that extends far beyond Columbia and Morningside Heights. Now, if you look around, it's not hard to find hints that this is what's going on. For example, take a look at what happened last night to pro-Hamas protesters who gathered outside the home of Chuck Schumer, who, of course, is the Senate Majority Leader. These are protesters who, for the most part, have had a free run of the campus of one of the top universities in the United States for several days. But watch what happens the moment they get near Chuck Schumer's house. Here it is.
There's pedestrian traffic. If you do not disperse, you will be arrested. You are creating a hazard.
Well, it worked. They did it. They freed Palestine. That's all it took. Stand outside of Chuck Schumer's house, and it'll result in something happening in the Middle East. Not exactly clear. What's amazing about this footage is that, as you might remember, left-wing activists recently gathered outside the homes of Supreme Court justices, including Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, for weeks on end. That was part of an overt effort to intimidate the justices ahead of the Dobbs decision. But at no point were the demonstrators arrested for picketing in front of the justices' homes, even though that was a violation of the federal law. Biden administration refused to do anything about it. It was like a scene out of a third world country. The only guy they arrested literally called 911 and told them he wanted to murder Kavanaugh. That's what it took to get some kind of police response in that case. But with Schumer, the rules are different. Hamas sympathizers and anti-Israel protesters can do what they want at NYU and Columbia and the University of Mexico and Cal Poly, but the one thing they can't do is disturb Chuck Schumer. So there are still rules, even amid all the anarchy. They just benefit, you know, the rules just happen to benefit members of one political party. As it happens, that's not the only indication that what we're seeing here is a kind of political operation. The Washington Examiner recently published a deep dive into the groups that have played a major role in promoting these Columbia protests, and one of these groups is called Jewish Voice for Peace, or JVP, which is a pro-Palestinian organization. They've helped with pro-Palestinian protests that have occurred not only at Columbia, but also at Harvard, UNC Chapel Hill, Ohio State, Boston University. And as the Examiner notes, JVP is supported by far-left George Soros' Open Society Network, and since 2016 has hauled in at least $650,000 from Soros-connected groups. Well, that's interesting. Especially if you were told that the protests at Columbia were spontaneous, that they were entirely student-run and student-funded and student-organized. Now we're learning that Soros-linked money is somehow involved in what's happening at Columbia. As you probably remember, Soros-affiliated entities famously poured millions of dollars into so-called racial justice initiatives beginning 4 years ago, the last time we had national riots, race riots in that case, and These entities also helped elect quite a few DAs all over the country who promised to further BLM's agenda by refusing to prosecute criminals. And now, according to The Examiner, Soros' Open Society Network is indirectly bankrolling some of what's happening at Columbia, or at least the organizations involved in it, which, again, is interesting. And it gets worse. Democrats like Cori Bush and Ilhan Omar have blamed the physical violence and threatening rhetoric at these protests on so-called outside agitators. That's always the line with these left-wing protests. And when anything bad happens, they always say, oh, these are the outside agitators. And in this case, we have sitting members of Congress and the Democrat Party making that claim. They're asserting that these agitators have nothing to do with the actual protest. But as the journalist Park McDougald has pointed out, one of the other key organizers of the Columbia protest, Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP, is a subsidiary of the same nonprofit as one of these alleged outside agitators, a group called Within Our Lifetimes, or WOL. The nonprofit is called the WESPAC Foundation, W-E-S-P-A-C Foundation. So in other words, there's no daylight here between the outside agitators and the protesters. They are one and the same, using the same money. And who funds the WESPAC Foundation, you ask? Well, as McDougald points out, that organization takes a lot of money from the Tides Foundation, which in turn has also received significant funding from the one and only George Soros. So as always, all roads lead back to Soros. So this is starting to look like more than an isolated protest. It's looking more like a broader and more general astroturfed effort to destabilize the country and stoke racial resentment right before an election with the full endorsement of the Democratic Party. There are some pretty clear signs that some of these students understand that too. Take the group called Columbia University Apartheid Divest, or QUAD. It's a large coalition of more than 116 groups, including JVP, that are organizing the occupation at Columbia right now. Some of these groups include the Columbia University Black Pre-Professional Society and White Coats for Black Lives. Now, you might be wondering why exactly a group of med students and other quote-unquote pre-professionals who support BLM also happen to be in lockstep in opposition to Israel and in support of Hamas. I mean, how exactly are these interests so perfectly aligned? Well, if you ask these students, they'll probably tell you what Ilhan Omar's daughter will tell you. She's, as we talked about yesterday, a student at Columbia who was just arrested for participating in this illegal encampment. She's also an avowed BLM activist. And they would all say that they're just really interested in defending allegedly marginalized people wherever they may be, here or in Gaza. And that probably is what many of these students believe, because they see anyone who is not white as a marginalized person. They see this as a conflict between whiteness and marginalized people of color. For them, this is a struggle against white power structures and systemic racism and colonialism, right? Whiteness is the real villain here. Just ask them that and they'll tell you. Now, in reality, does the war in Israel have anything to do with whiteness or systemic racism or anything like that? Of course not. But that's how they see it. And if they didn't see it that way, they wouldn't care. At least they certainly wouldn't care as much as they do. You know, there was no occupation of university campuses over the Ukraine invasion. And that's because though leftists like to pretend they care about Ukraine, and they do care about it more than they should, but they don't care about it this much. Because when it comes down to it, in Ukraine and Russia, both parties are equally white. So there's only so much sympathy they can really have for white people, even the white ones in Ukraine. But things start to get a little confusing when you look at other groups that have signed on to this collective at Columbia. They include the Columbia Queer Alliance, the Queer Graduate Collective, and my personal favorite, the Students Organization of Latines, or SOL. Those are groups that, if they step foot in Gaza, would immediately be stoned to death. Hamas doesn't exactly take kindly to the sorts of people who call themselves queer. So it's a little harder to explain their membership in this coalition. But it becomes less difficult if you see these protests, as many Democratic leaders do see them, which is yet another opportunity for the Democratic Party and their various activist groups to terrorize millions of people and derail the national conversation in an election year. It's not exactly surprising that colleges, once again, are ground zero for this effort. Universities have been fomenting this kind of radicalism for decades, and now they're reaping exactly what they've sown. None of these universities deserve our sympathy, obviously. And for that matter, none of them deserve the benefit of student loan forgiveness programs either. If anyone should pay for these students' loans, it's the endowments of these schools, which are now so dysfunctional that it borders on comical. Here, for example, are protesters late last night at Columbia talking about dispersing into platoons so they'll be harder to arrest. Watch.
But we will know because of that in advance of an imminent sweep. We are entering a period of high alert for the next 3 days. And that is why I urge all of you to talk to your friends as well and let them know that we may need people to turn up quickly, en masse, in front of the encampment to defend the encampment. Will you be ready to rally for your comrades? We are so close to divestment!
So they're comrades in arms, ready to fight for whatever the cause of the day happens to be. And they're desperate. A lot of this is also just the fact that these kids are desperate for a cause. You know, some of this is the kind of revolutionary spirit that young people naturally have. And so they're desperate for some sort of cause. They'll take anything. Anything that comes along, they'll take because they need to feel like they're fighting for something. Now, as Aaron Sabarian points out, these protesters want to make it as difficult as possible for the police to remove them so that when they are removed, they can claim to be victims. That is their overriding motivation here. What they may not know, although it's pretty obvious at this point, is that these kids on campus here are not simply idiots. In an election year, they are useful idiots. And in the next few months, the party that controls the government right now is going to take full advantage of them. Let's get to our five headlines. Are you tired of your favorite cut of beef or chicken costing more and weighing less every time you buy it from the store? Well, Good Ranchers has a sizzling solution for you with their Price Lock Guarantee. During their April Price Shield campaign, Good Ranchers is not just offering a temporary fix, but a long-term solution. They're locking in your price until 2026 when you subscribe to one of their boxes. GoodRanchers.com is where I get the most tender meat that is full of flavor every time. With options like beef, chicken, pork, and wild-caught seafood, they have something for even the pickiest of eaters. Now, there's no reason to order takeout when you can make something far better at home. If your excuse is that you can't cook, well, Good Ranchers has a list of recipes to take your terrible cooking skills and turn you into an incredible chef. So with meat prices continuing to go up and quality at the store continuing to go down, Good Ranchers Price Shield will not only save you hundreds, but give you the best 100% American quality meat that you'll ever eat. Right now, when you go to GoodRanchers.com and use promo code Walsh, you'll get their exclusive Price Shield and additional 10% off your order. This offer ends at the end of the month, so if you want to secure your best price on meat until 2026, go to GoodRanchers.com, use my code Walsh. That's GoodRanchers.com with promo code Walsh today. Start with this from News Channel 5 here in Nashville. A bill that would allow some Tennessee teachers to carry a gun at school is heading to Governor Bill Lee's desk. HB 1202, SB 1325 has drawn heavy attention from parents, teachers, students, and law enforcement. The bill would allow specially trained teachers to carry handguns in their classrooms. Under the bill, parents would not know whether their child's teacher was armed or not. This bill has been on hold for about a year. Originally, it was introduced by Representative Ryan Williams and Senator Paul Bailey in January. Movement on the bill stalled when the Senate Judiciary Committee abruptly closed after the Covenant School shooting that left six dead, including three nine-year-olds. In the aftermath, lawmakers battled over whether to take up any gun-related bills. Ultimately, Republicans said any gun bill following the Covenant shooting was too emotionally charged. That stoked the fire for the Tennessee Three, where three Democratic lawmakers stood on the House floor in protest of gun violence, as you may remember. But Democrats are very upset about this, bill. Representative Justin Jones said, "This bill is insane. For God's sake, you don't hear. You should be ashamed. You hold our state at gunpoint. May democracy see you out of your seats." This guy, who talks like that? Nope, no one talks like that. No real human talks like, may democracy see you out of your seats, sir. The hell does that even mean? Other Democratic lawmakers were worried about liability and insurance costs for school districts if teachers were carrying weapons. Others worried this plan would create more collateral damage, that this bill would give a, quote, pop gun to go up against a weapon of war. Representative Bo Mitchell said, this is what we're going to do in reaction to teachers and children being murdered in a school. Our reaction is to throw more guns at it. What's wrong with us? Now we'll get into this issue, of course, in a moment, but I also want to read through the requirements that must be fulfilled in order for a teacher to carry a gun, because they're not just going to hand guns out to any teacher that wants one. So here it is. For those teachers wanting to carry a gun in school, it is a multi-step process. Teachers wanting to carry will have to have, one, written authorization from the principal, the superintendent, and the head of law enforcement in their city or county. Two, complete 40 hours of basic training in school policing and 40 hours of post-commission approved training that is specific to school policing each year to keep the authorization. Three, must obtain a background check. And four, undergo a psychological exam conducted by a Tennessee-licensed psychologist. So those are the requirements. I think those are good requirements. They make sense. But still, as we've heard, Democrats were very upset, very performatively upset, which is the only way that they're ever upset about anything, is performatively. So one of the ways of communicating their sadness over this bill, it was to stage a die-in, as they call it, they call it a die-in, but it's a very convenient kind of protest because it really just, it allows you to take a nap during the workday and call it a political demonstration. So let's take a look at some of the footage of this die-in here. Yeah, so they're just napping is what they're doing. They're just taking a nap. It's like nap time at kindergarten. We're just missing the alphabet rug. All right. And they're strewn all over the floor there. Well, now obviously this is proof yet again that our politics is dominated by cringy theater kids and other nerds desperate for attention. Like, I wish we could go a month without some politician somewhere staging some kind of elaborate performance that only succeeds in proving what kind of a useless dork that politician is. I wish we could go a month, but we can't. As to the issue itself, obviously we should let teachers carry guns if they want to and if they're trained and if they're approved. This argument that somehow a school shooting is made worse by having other armed people there is insane. You always hear this nonsense. You know, this, you can't help the situation by adding more guns. We're going to add more guns? We think that's going to solve something? Like, as if we're just dumping a box of guns into the middle of the classroom. When you say add more guns, that's what it sounds like. We're just throwing guns into the room. That's not what's happening. What's happening? We're adding a person who is armed. That's what we're adding to the equation. So here's the question. I think this is really the only question that matters, or at least it is the first question and the most important question that we should ask. And it's this. If a bad guy with a gun comes into the school and walks into your kid's classroom, is it better? Is it preferable that the bad guy, the psychopath mass murderer, is the only one armed in the room? Is that better? Is that a better situation? Will you take solace in the knowledge that at least the mass killer is the only one with a gun? Is that better than having someone else there who is also armed? Do you want all of the potential victims to be helpless and defenseless? Is helplessness and defenselessness a superior alternative? Really? Now, if you answer yes to any of those questions, then you're just a maniac. I don't know what to say. You're insane. It's an insane position to take. Obviously, it's better if there's someone if there's a crazy killer in the classroom with a gun, Clearly, it's better if at least someone else there also has a gun. Like, it can't be. How could it make the situation worse? This is the worst case situation that you're facing. It can't get worse than that. And don't tell me, because this is the other answer that I hate. Where you say, school shootings shouldn't happen in the first place. You know, that's what, this is a false choice. What I choose is that the school shootings won't happen. I choose for there to be no school shootings in the first place. You know, that's my brilliant plan. Yes, well, I prefer that too. Genius. That would very much be my own preference. If someone gave me a choice between there being school shootings and there not being school shootings, I would choose the latter very quickly. Okay, if there was a magical button that I could press to make school shootings just not happen in the first place, I would prefer that over the option of having armed teachers that are fighting the bad guys. But that's not a choice that exists. That magical button doesn't exist. I don't have that choice. You don't have that choice. We prefer if school shootings don't happen, but they do. And what then? What do we do when the thing that shouldn't happen does happen? And this is a question, even if we passed every gun law, every gun control law that the left wants, which we shouldn't pass any of them. But even if we did, every law they want, we pass. Let's just say that we do. School shootings can still happen. Okay, unless you confiscate and destroy every gun on planet Earth and also somehow prevent any more from being produced in the future, which is impossible. Anything short of that, school shootings can still happen. And so we're still left with the same question, which is, what happens if it does? What then? The guy with the gun comes into the classroom. Yeah, he shouldn't be there. It should be. It is illegal. He's already broken 50 laws just by walking in with a gun in the first place. It shouldn't happen. It's a terrible thing that it is happening, but it's happening. And so, what then? What is the best way to respond in that situation? Obviously, having someone there who is prepared to defend themselves and the lives of the children is preferable, even if it doesn't work. Like, it's better than nothing. Having some ability to fight back is better than having no ability, right? I mean, do you apply this kind of logic to anything else in your life? Do you refuse to wear a seatbelt out of principle because car accidents shouldn't happen? You know, if someone told you to put your seatbelt on, would you say, no, I'm not going to put it on. I'm just not going to have a car. I don't plan on having a car accident. I disagree with car accidents. I don't think they should happen. Like, if I tell you to put your seatbelt on, is that because I'm pro car accidents? Am I some sort of like part of the car accident lobby? Is that what this is? Do you refuse to lock your front door at night on the basis that burglary shouldn't happen? Well, they shouldn't happen, but they do. And what happens when they happen? Do you walk downstairs and see the burglar and say, excuse me, burglar, do you realize you're not supposed to be doing this? This is not supposed to happen. Sir, I would like to inform you that I prefer it if you did not burglarize my property. That's what I prefer. How's that going to work out? What's going to, maybe the burglar will say, oh, really? You didn't want me to burglarize your, I didn't, oh, I'm not supposed to do this? You mean I don't sneak into your house in the middle of the night with a ski mask and all that? You don't want that. Oh, you don't? Let me just put your TV back and I'll be on my way. I guess that could happen, but it's probably not going to happen. And that's why you need to be prepared to deal with the worst case situation. Because the worst can happen and does happen and will happen to someone, at least. Maybe not you, but maybe you and maybe your children. In that scenario, you know, without another gun in the classroom, without someone else armed in the classroom, when that guy walks in, the guy or girl, as was the case in Covenant, when he or she walks in, the only thing that these kids can do and the teachers can do is like huddle in a corner and hide under their desk. I mean, it's absurd, really, that anyone would want for that to be the only defense mechanism. You want that to be the only defense mechanism that your children have? What the hell is wrong with you? Do you even love your kids? Honestly. Crazy guys in the classroom, you want the only defense mechanism to be a freaking desk? It's crazy to me. It's just insane. I can't even... It's not just crazy. It's like repulsive. Just get over your gun thing. Whatever your problem is with guns, just get over it. Grow up, okay? Because, you know, there are scenarios that are solved with guns. Yes, there are problems that can be solved with guns and with nothing else. School shooter in the classroom, only thing that solves that is a gun. Only thing. Nothing else solves it. Nothing. All right, here's a report about a female college student who was nearly robbed on camera, on security camera on campus, was nearly robbed, but managed to fight back. And I want you to watch this video and pay special attention to what's happening, or what's not happening, I suppose, in the foreground of this video. Here it is.
It was just before 3 in the 5600 block of South University. Maddie says a confrontation happened and the suspect demanded her phone before flashing the gun. The pair got into a tussle.
I was grabbing for maybe my phone, maybe the gun. It's really like a blackout moment for me. And I realized that I was able to grab the magazine out of the gun.
The loaded magazine, now in police custody, Maddie says, and she hopes it will help solve the crime. Just minutes after that ordeal sent people in the area scrambling to safety, another armed robbery involving two suspects with handguns reported in the 1300 block of East 56th Street. That crime under investigation by the Chicago Police Department.
I want to feel safer on this campus. That's the bottom line.
But I think we can always ask for more from our campus and our city.
Maddie says she hopes fellow students and staff are vigilant and keep their guard up. When all said and done, she says her reaction was a knee-jerk one, and she's thankful to be okay.
I couldn't necessarily really register the threat ahead of me, so definitely wouldn't advocate for fighting back. Losing a life over a phone is definitely not worth it.
So she removed the magazine from the gun, and I will say, which, I mean, obviously all credit goes to her for fighting back successfully. I will say a word of warning to anyone in the future: if you're in this situation and you manage to remove the magazine from your attacker's gun, one thing you should realize is that he might still have a bullet in the chamber, so you're not necessarily home free. So just something to keep in mind. But the thing that many people have zeroed in on, the detail that stands out the most in that video, is the other guy, the guy who was not involved and remained not involved, and who was sitting in the grass and watching this unfold. So if you're listening on the audio podcast, you didn't, of course, see that, but that's what you see in the video. There's some other guy who's probably, I don't know, 15 feet away watching this. We don't know who that guy is, but he sat there and he watched while this woman struggled with her attacker, and he did not appear to lift a finger to help. Now, many people have condemned this guy. They've called him a coward, selfish, weak, so on and so forth. They say that he had a duty to intervene, to protect the innocent, to be a man, et cetera. And listen, if that were me, of course, it's easy to say not being in the situation, but if that were me, I would step in because I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I watched that happen. Especially if it played out differently and the woman was killed, God forbid, in the struggle. I wouldn't be able to live with myself having witnessed that and not at least attempted to do anything about it. So I think that I would intervene. But can we blame this guy for not doing anything? The answer is that we can't blame him, really. We have lost the right as a society to expect men to step up in those situations. In fact, I say that I think that I would intervene, again, acknowledging that you can't really say for sure what you would do unless you're in that situation. But I'm not even sure that I could say that that's morally the right thing in the current climate. Especially if you have a family and kids of your own. who need you. Because why is that? Well, there are several reasons, but starting with the most obvious, men who intervene are frequently arrested and sent to prison. Daniel Penny is facing years in prison right now for doing exactly what the Twitter mob wants this other guy to have done. Look, I mean, it's one thing to ask a man to risk his life and, to protect the innocent. It's one thing to ask that. And I think that in an ideal situation, we should ask men to do that. But it's another thing to tell him that he must risk his life. And if he survives, he'll go to jail. Like the idea that this guy, just because he happened to be there, is now required to either die or go to jail. He's required to put himself in a position where the two top most likely outcomes are death and jail. Like, we just can't, that's an absurd idea. We can't expect that. So is that what it is? Like, he just happens to be there, and now it's like, well, sorry, man, your life is over. Because this other guy has chosen to do something. Because you happen to witness it, your life has to be over. You have to do something now where either you will die or probably go to prison. Sorry, that just your luck. Sorry about your luck. Your life's over. I know you had other plans maybe, and maybe you have a family at home. That's why I say I can't even, I don't know, again, we don't know this guy's situation, but you got a family at home, let's say. Is it even morally right for you to do something knowing there's a high likelihood that no matter how it turns out, your family will be deprived of you maybe forever? Now you're sort of putting someone else above your family in a way that I'm not sure can even be morally justified. So it's not fair. You can't, as a society, say men should protect the innocent and also say men who protect the innocent are murderers who deserve to rot in prison. You can't do both. It has to be one or the other. You cannot have both. If you want heroism from men, if you want men to protect the innocent, you have to encourage that. You have to do something to incentivize it. You can't go out of your way to ruthlessly disincentivize that behavior and then still expect the behavior that you're disincentivizing. It's insane. You know, these societies in the past where a woman would get attacked and, five men would spring into action. And, I think that some of that is overstated. But still, those societies praised and adored men for doing that. They honored them. Like in the past, a guy like Daniel Penny, there would be no thought to putting him in jail. He would get a medal. He would be a hero. They'd get him a medal. He'd be getting free beer to every bar he went to for the rest of his life in the past. And guess what? When you treat Daniel Penny that way, you get a lot more Daniel Pennies. You honor these men, you respect them. Men respond to that. Men will die for honor and respect. They will. That's the story of human civilization. Men doing great heroic things for honor and respect and dying in the process. Men are willing to die for that. And that's a good kind of society to have. But you cannot remove the honor and respect and still require the honorable, respectable behavior. You can't do that. You just can't. Men will die for honor and respect, but what happens when they don't? But if it's not there, if it's not on, instead of honor and respect, they get condemnation and prison time, then you're not going to get it. You know, C.S. Lewis said that you can't make men without chess and expect virtue and enterprise. Well, in this case, we're putting the men with chess in prison, and then we're expecting virtue and enterprise. We're saying, hey, men, be virtuous and courageous so that we can condemn you and defame you and throw you in jail. Like, not exactly a sales pitch. Again, I think as a society, we can expect men to do things that put their lives at risk. We can expect that. As a man, I am saying that it's valid for me to be expected in certain circumstances to put my very life at risk. I accept that calling. I do, but, or I would. but you cannot expect them to risk their lives when the reward for surviving the risk is, rather than honor, dishonor and shame and prison. Because that's the other part, too. It's not just that men who do the right thing are put in prison. It's that they are shamed. They're doing the honorable thing. They're doing it for honor and respect, but they're not. But then they're shamed. They're given shame for it. So what are you supposed to do? It's just like, you know, the classic women and children first on the lifeboats on the Titanic. In principle, I agree with that. And I think that that's a good principle to have, that men, certainly children should go first. I mean, every adult should want children to be rescued. But then women too. Yeah, but once again, you can't do that. And then also say that the men who are saying women and children go first are misogynistic, sexist, backwards barbarians. It can't be both. You can't do both. Cannot do both. So the onus goes back to society. It goes back to all of these people, you know, who are shaming these men who don't step up. The onus goes back to you. Well, like, you better be there to praise and honor the men who do the right thing. And if you don't, then you have no right. If you do not praise and honor men who do the right thing, you have no right to expect them to do the right thing. And there are plenty of individuals in our society who do praise and honor men who do the right thing, but as a culture, culture-wide, we don't. And you create these lose-lose situations, although now it's really like it's a lose-lose-lose situation, you know? Because if you're a man, and believe me, this is something that every man thinks about. Every man has thought about this, has thought about these scenarios, given the circumstances we live in, and cases like Daniel Penny. We've all thought about, like, what happens? What happens if I happen to be just walking down the street, minding my own business, and I happen to see some terrible thing happening to somebody else? I got nothing to do with it. What do I do? Because it's a lose-lose-lose situation. Because if you step in and you're not successful in your intervention, you'll die. If you step in and you're successful, you might well go to prison. And if you don't do anything, you'll be shamed as a coward. So this is a situation men are in. It's like completely unfair. If you just happen to be in the vicinity of something bad happening, automatically your life is ruined just because you happen to be there. No matter what you do, you're either dead in jail or shamed as a coward for the rest of your life. Just because you happen to be around. That is the impossible situation that we've created for people. And so, no, the problem is not that guy. The problem is the impossible situation that he was in. The tax deadline just passed. Well, you know, if you owe back taxes or still have unfiled returns, it can really weigh on your mind, especially when the IRS has become more determined than ever. Their chief data analytics officer revealed that the IRS is focused on an enforcement project with an average return on investment of about $6 for every $1 spent. They're targeting individuals and businesses that currently owe back taxes or haven't yet filed their returns. Tax Network USA, the nation's leading tax relief firm, knows the tax code and will fight for you. With a record of negotiating over $1 billion in tax relief for their clients, their team is knowledgeable in handling any type of tax issue. Whether you owe $10,000 or $10 million, they can help. Even if you don't have all your personal or business records from over the years, they can get you filed up to date. Facing the IRS without a professional is not a smart move. Contact Tax Network USA for the best strategic advice to help reduce or even eliminate your tax debt. Call today at 1-800-245-6000 or visit their website at tnusa.com/walsh. They'll give you a free private consultation on how you can settle your tax debt today at tnusa.com/walsh. As Russia continues to capture global headlines with its controversial actions, What We Saw, an Empire of Terror, hosted by Bill Whittle, provides a timely exploration of the country's tumultuous history. The complete series is now streaming exclusively on Daily Wire Plus. You can explore the extreme depths of communist policies and the brutal treatment of its people under Joseph Stalin, showcasing the worst of Soviet Russia that history books refuse to reveal. This tale of terror provides a compelling presentation of the horrors that plagued the Soviet Union and the viciousness of its leaders. Understand the centuries-long history that shaped modern-day Russia and the communist ideology that threatens our homeland. Watch What We Saw, an Empire of Terror, streaming now exclusively on Daily Wire Plus. If you're not a member, sign up today at dailywireplus.com. Now let's get to our daily cancellation. We begin the daily cancellation today with what has become a classic TikTok genre. This is the video of someone documenting an average day in their life. You see them wake up in the morning, make breakfast, drive to work, eat lunch, etc. Nothing extraordinary, even mildly interesting happens. The only thing unusual about the day, as they document it, is that they are documenting it. You know, I watch these videos fascinated only by the number of camera angles they use and cuts they have to make. As a content creator myself, as much as I despise that title, I can't help but marvel at the effort that must go into creating this sort of content, not to mention the public embarrassment you must endure when other shoppers at the grocery store see you setting up your tripod to capture footage of yourself picking up a bag of green peppers or whatever. It all seems very bizarre. What is being filmed isn't bizarre, but rather the fact that it's being filmed is what's bizarre. But maybe the joke's on me, though. These videos seem totally pointless from my perspective, and yet they tend to provoke a strong reaction from many people on the internet. Then again, everything provokes a strong reaction on the internet. You know, the internet has never shrugged its shoulders at anything and said, oh, okay, that's fine. Whatever. Nothing is fine. Everything is either really terrible or really amazing, and there is no room for anything else to exist anywhere else on that continuum. So these day-in-the-life videos must either be amazing or terrible, and usually they're judged to be the latter. That's been the consensus over the past several days as videos from some random guy on TikTok have gone viral. The videos, I've seen three of them circulating, all show this guy going about, I don't know his name, but he's going about his daily routine. Again, nothing remarkable happens, nothing strange, nothing interesting, nothing notable about it. But the videos have elicited a strong and often negative reaction. I'll play one of the videos now and then read a few of the comments. Apologies in advance to listeners of the audio podcast. You're not going to get a lot of out of this, but as the viewers of the video version can attest, you also aren't missing much. Here it is.
Cheers.
Okay, so riveting stuff. The guy wakes up, has a smoothie for breakfast, takes the trash out, goes to work at his office job, comes home, takes his dog out, then gets changed into sweatpants and relaxes for the night. Very normal day. Normal dude doing normal things. Only a one-minute snapshot. There are 17 or 18 waking hours in the average day, so most of it will be left out. This guy also has a wife who we don't see in the video, and apparently his wife is pregnant, as I understand it. And that fact is not featured in the clip. But the one-minute snapshot we do see is totally fine and unobjectionable. Granted, again, the fact that we're given this snapshot, the fact that he's filming this in the first place, is strange. There are criticisms you can levy against this kind of content, but there's nothing offensive about the thing that's being documented, the 9-to-5 routine itself. And yet, the Peanut Gallery on Twitter has responded to this video like it's an image of pure despair and horror. Somebody named Keith Woods, who advertises himself in his bio as one of the top 200 most influential Twitter users, left this caption when he responded to that video, when he reposted that video, rather. This is the caption he left. Imagine living like this until you die. Horrifying. That had nearly 5,000 likes. Many other comments agreed with that sentiment. Reading a few, quote, I don't know if it's this guy's demeanor or just how empty his life seems, but this is literally the most depressing video I've ever seen. Someone else says, This is slavery with a nicer kitchen and bed. Hell on earth, someone else says. I agree, it's horrifying. Many other comments along these lines. Calling the guy a wage slave, declaring that his 9-to-5 lifestyle is a nightmare beyond all imagining. Generally reacting to a video of a guy going to work as if it's a snuff film. Now, I tweeted that I don't quite see the problem with the way this guy's living, and many people responded with comments informing me that I only have that opinion because I am also a soulless robot. Here's one comment for reference, quote, chances are 10 out of 10 that Matt is a super basic automaton conservatard in real life. Nothing remotely novel or interesting about him. Now, I would obviously disagree with the automaton and conservatard labels, but the rest I'll accept. I'm not sure what a super basic life is, but if that's my life, fine. I go to work. I take care of my family. Perhaps it's a basic life in that way. I'm okay with that. I'm also not striving to live in a way that random social media accounts would find novel and interesting. In fact, if novelty is a guiding principle of your life, then it's virtually guaranteed that you're a dysfunctional loser. Functional adults with responsibilities don't go around chasing novelty. And at any rate, I can guarantee that the people who pretend to recoil in horror at 9-to-5 jobs and who lambast the rest of us for living uninteresting lives by their standards are not themselves doing anything interesting at all, okay? These people are not jungle explorers or engineers working on building a rocket ship to take humans to Mars or anything like that. I mean, these are losers who have lives far more monotonous and pointless than the average middle-class 9-to-5 worker. These people sit around on their fat asses staring at screens all day and then declare that office jobs are beneath them. I need something more fulfilling and worthwhile and fascinating to satisfy my wild and inquisitive nature, declares the guy who's been scrolling through TikTok videos for the past 7.5 hours. So there's a certain irony here. Yet it has become, very popular to hate on the 9-to-5 routine. You hear it from people on the left who say that the normal workday is somehow oppressive to the human spirit. And now we hear it from those on the right, some on the right, who have adopted the same language to describe the lives of normal people who go to work every day to provide for themselves and their families. Now, I think as conservatives, we should be aggressively defending normalcy. We should stand for normalcy. There's nothing wrong with being normal. It is a leftist view that normal is automatically bad. So if you're doing something normal, you have to change it and do something different just for the sake of being different. Both sides, or at least a vocal and often younger element on both sides, have come to a consensus that your average 9-to-5 job is a nightmare, worse than death itself. It is slavery, they say. Well, let me make two points about this. First of all, I don't personally have a normal 9-to-5 job myself. I earn a living in a way that is somewhat unusual. Everybody on earth has a podcast these days, so there's nothing unique about that. But it is relatively unusual to make enough money to support a family this way. And yet, so I'm not defending the 9-to-5 routine because I'm defending myself. But I would never look down on the average 9-to-5 office worker. Most of them are doing jobs far more essential than what I do for a living, first of all. And in fact, office workers basically run the world. Nothing would work without those guys doing those jobs. But get rid of all the cubicle office jobs, make them all evaporate, so that we're free. Okay, good job. Nothing works anymore. All of society collapses, you idiots. What do you think? Do you think you could use your phone? You think you could get electricity? You think you could turn your lights on? You think you could do anything without people doing those jobs? No, you moron. But no matter how essential or inessential any of those jobs may seem, I respect anyone who earns an honest living to care for themselves and their families. Calling average middle-class workers automatons and drones and slaves is about the snobbiest, most elitist position you can take. And it's even worse because, as we've established, many of the people who've taken this elitist position are by no means and by no measure actually elite in any sense of the word. Second, adult life is one of work and routine. There is no way around the work unless you're on welfare or you were born a billionaire. In which case, in either case, you have no right to judge anyone who actually works for a living, no matter what kind of job they have. As for the second part, there is no way around routine, even if you're a billionaire or a welfare queen. Everyone has a routine. Life is dominated by routine and establishing effective routines. Routines that help you to be productive and to fulfill your responsibilities. That is an essential part of growing up and maturing. That's why I say if you find the routine itself to be horrifying, it's because you're a child. You're an emotional and mental child if that's how you react to it. It's a routine. This is what life is. Nobody has an exciting daily routine, okay? Even people with interesting jobs don't have exciting daily routines. Batman doesn't have an exciting daily routine. The only people who have no routines at all are homeless schizophrenics. So if you want to have no job and no routine and every day is an adventure, then you could be a homeless schizophrenic. That's what you can be. That's it. If you're not that, then your life is dominated by routines. The only question is whether those routines are productive or not, whether they are effective or not. Work and routine. That is what the lion's share of life consists of. So welcome to human existence. This is what it's like. This is how it goes. If you're horrified by a guy with a job and a routine, it's not the job or the routine that you loathe. It is existence itself. You apparently find human existence by its nature to be awful and oppressive. And you know, that's a problem because there is only one alternative to existence. And if you don't want to avail yourself of that option, and I hope you don't, then you need to get used to life and learn to find joy in it. Either way, the problem is with you, not the guy working in a cubicle. And that is why the people pretending to be horrified by 9-to-5 jobs, whether they're on the right or the left, are all today canceled. That'll do it for the show today. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Talk to you tomorrow. Godspeed.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.